Because do we have all of them here?
Let me have a look. So we have on the agenda. We have
This is something else.
We have Stefan, we have Dave Knight, we have Beckwith.
This is Stefan.
Yeah, that's okay.
This is Dave Knight.
Carson is fine.
Good job, man. Okay, thank you. Excellent. Good morning, everybody. This is the DNS Working Group, in case some of you didn't know that. If you were expecting to have discussions about internet exchanges and peering policies and stuff like that, I think you'd be in the wrong room and you might want to go next door. Before we get things underway, one or two announcements. First of all, is the proceedings are being recorded and webcast. So whenever you come to the mics to make any comments or questions, please give your name and affiliations. This will help the scribes, it'll help the nice lady that's doing the transcription services, and it will also help the people that are out there in webland following proceedings and may not always be fully aware of recognising whose voice is whose. Could I also ask you to please make sure that you've got your cell phones and pagers switched to silent mode or something like that. It's nothing more annoying than having any discussions going on or phones going off while people are trying to discuss things and make presentations in the working group. As you know, we've got the usual stuff here. Peter's kind of put up some slides here with the obvious things. There's the homepage for the working group, how to contact us through the mailing list, and the co-chairs for the working group are myself, Jim Reid. Peter Koch is going to chair the second session this afternoon, and Jaap Akkerhuis, I hope, is somewhere hiding in the room here at the moment. Having looked at the agenda, I just want to ask quickly. There he is there. He's in the obvious place, where I didn't even need to look for Jaap. Anyway. Have we also looked through the agenda? Has there any comments to make on the actual ordering that we have here or any other suggestions for agenda items or things that we've not otherwise got covered? Are we all broadly happy with that? Okay, then. Next thing is we've got the minutes of the Reich 58 meeting, and these were posted very late, for which your co-chairs have to apologise. It's their inability to do things rather than the NCC's. We got the minutes early enough, and collectively we dropped the ball in actually getting the minutes updated and checked and then circulated. However, I apologise for that. And considering your co-chairs have had their wrists well and truly slapped, and they make sure that we don't make the same mistake in future. And I think Peter's going to go through the actual open agenda items from right 58 minutes, so the action item list and any action items or things that you've discussed on the right 58 minutes. Peter? Next slide.
Okay, thanks, Jim. Good morning. I now have the interesting task of going through some of the action items. You find the action item list, the full action item list, on the under the URL posted on the slides. Slides are available online as well, of course. Why do we have two numbers for this action item? Well, that's cut and paste, but that also happened last time, which means that the background of this was the NCC found out that the trust anchors for the NCC maintained zones had appeared in the ISC DLV, and there was some discussion about this back and forth. And actually, at RIPE 57 and then subsequently at RIPE 58, the NCC received the task to work on this with ISC and give us some update and background. And actually, that's going to happen in the RIPE NCC update that Anand will give this afternoon. Then we had two other action items arising from last time. The first, which is 58.2, also originating from Anand's then RIPE NCC report, where they found out that some of the objects in the database were actually causing more trouble than use. That is, child objects of INADRA ARPA or IP6.ARPA for that matter being registered, where the registrant or the LIR submitting the stuff would expect these to provision these zones to reflect this information in the respective reverse zones at the NCC. But since the parent zone was already provisioned there, these child information would have no effect to the confusion of everybody because there's no error report and nothing. I guess that will be covered in Anand's report as well. And we just talked to the talked about this in the RIPE database working group, and the database group of the RIPE NCC, and Paul is sitting in the back, I guess. Sorry for putting you on the spot. They're working on this to clean this up. There's a couple of numbers, several thousand objects affected here, which do not have any effect. So I guess probably on the list or at the next RIPE meeting, we can have a progress report on this. It has actually received another action item number in the database working group, if memory serves correctly. Is that right, Paul? Okay. Anyway, it's been taken care of there. Then another issue that arose from Anand's report and then from subsequent discussion, which we unfortunately had to cut down a bit last time, but we'll continue this afternoon, was about the lame delegation project, or actually the lame delegation detection project, carried out by the NCC. We had some discussion. Shane made several comments and had a proposal, and the NCC was asked to dig further into this and do some research, and they cooperated with Shane, and we will see the presentation this afternoon, and I guess Anand will also touch upon this in his report this afternoon. So for now, we can't close any of these, but probably can do so after this afternoon's presentations. There are, maybe I forgot to put them on here, there are some other older action items we can report progress on. The one is that there was the RevServ attribute in INADNUM objects, which in ancient times had probably some function documenting the reverse delegation name service for these address objects. The latest, after the introduction of the domain objects for the reverse tree, these RevServ attributes in the INADNUM objects didn't have any particular use. So we came up with a proposal a couple of RIPE meetings ago to get rid of this. This was taken over to the database working group. They agreed. The RIPE NCC received an action item there. Everything is done. These RevServ attributes have been converted into remarks only, and so we can close this one. Another one that is still being worked on in the database department, which is probably of interest here as well, since we touched upon it, that is forward domain objects in the RIPE database. So we have a couple of TLD objects, either referring to the TLD's web, sorry, not web server, Whois server, or some random second, third level domain objects in the RIPE database. And the agreement here was to, for the sake of consistency and data maintenance, quality and everything, to get rid of this information in the RIPE database. This is still on the desk of the database group in the NCC, and ongoing action item, and progress will be reported next time. And that should be basically it. Any questions? Thank you. Back to the agenda and Jim.
Okay, next up we have Carsten Strutman, who's going to give us an update on what's been happening at the ITF reports.
Good morning, hello. Update on what's happened in DNS-related space on the ITF, which happened end of July in sunny Stockholm. I'm starting with the DNS extensions working group here, and there was a lengthy discussion about these two drafts, which stem back from the Kaminsky issues last summer. Which handle about all the ideas that can be done to make DNS more resilient. Some of the ideas being in this document have been seen as not optimal or might be hurting more than they can solve or help the DNS. So there was kind of discussion around this, whether it is dangerous to put them in an RFC, because that might be kind of a Midas touch that something which is not good turns into gold by putting it in an RFC, but it might turn out to be a fool's gold. So there was then, after discussion, four options being presented what to do in the working group, and the minus and the pluses indicate the amount of humming or silence in the room, where more minuses mean more silent and more pluses mean more humming in the room. And you see that for the option do nothing, there was silence. To adopt the first draft, there was even more silence. It is like I had the feeling during the issue that this is like nuclear waste. It's there, but nobody wants to touch it. And then the second draft, there was also silent, but not as much as for the first draft. And there was some adoption, some positive feedback, but not much, a little bit, to adopt both drafts and merge them together and work on them further. So we have to see what happens there in the next time. Then there's this new draft about the overhaul of the EDNS0. That one got a new editor, Michael Gruff, working now on this. And Eric Osterweil presented some interesting data about a tool, or in general, he presented about DNS parse MTU. That is the how to measure the packet sizes being able to work with on a line of DNS servers, like a line of resolving DNS server that a DNS query might go through, because all that DNS servers might have different EDNS capabilities and packet size capabilities. And there is a tool called DNS Funnel that you can download as part of a larger package from this URL there, where you can test the DNS path MTU yourself and do some testing on that. And then there was very little discussion on a topic that is being discussed in the Behave working group. It's called Behave DNS 6.4, and it's basically about synthesizing Quad A records out of A records for being able to, from an IP version 6 only network, to be able to access IP version 4 content. Andrew Sullivan, the co-editor and also working group chair, asked for feedback on the from the DNS extension working group to give feedback to the behave working group, and that is worked on. Then Shane Kerr presented a draft about IKEs of our only, which deals with incremental zone transfers. Today's incremental zone transfer works in a way that if a DNS server asks for an incremental zone transfer and the other party, the master, cannot deliver an incremental zone transfer, it will send just a full zone transfer, which is not always the best solution for it, because a slave name server might have multiple masters, and the slave name server might want to first try multiple masters if they can deliver an incremental zone transfer before it receives a full zone transfer, especially in large zones. So this new addition, this new query type, will be IKEs of our only. And if the master cannot deliver an incremental zone transfer, the master should just send back an error message instead of a full zone transfer. There was a mild hum in the working group to adopt this document, and it has been discussed further on the mailing list. And then more larger discussion, well, 5 minutes left, happened about the chart changes, mostly about a DNS RFC guide, because it was seen that, especially for developers, new developers, it's almost impossible to get an overview on how to implement DNS correctly, because there are so many RFCs. Some are obsolete, some are updated, some are obscure, some are not complete. So the idea was to create a yearly summary of all DNS RFCs that are a needed read for implementers. There was a big discussion on which form this document should be. Should it be an RFC, a wiki, a live document, or anything else? The result was something is needed, but it should not be an RFC. So now it's the big discussion how an ITF working group can work on anything else which is not an RFC. So then we have a presentation on a single query type that will make a DNS server return both A and quad A records. So to get rid of the overhead that we have today, because today a client might first ask for a quad A record. If that is not available, ask for an A record. So the idea is to combine both in one query type. The working group indicated that this is interesting. Work needs to be done on this, but not this draft. So there will be probably more work being seen in the ITF on this one. And then there is a new draft on signaling the algorithm understood or desired by a validating resolver, because having multiple different encryption algorithms in DNSSEC can lead to really big package sizes. So then there might be a good idea to have the resolver indicating what algorithms the resolver understands, so that the DNS server can just respond with these algorithms and not with everything available. This is being worked on, and Paul Hoffman volunteered to write an internet draft on this for consideration. So that was the DNS extensions working group. Now coming to the DNS operation working group. There was a draft which deals with all the implications between various timing parameters in DNSSEC. This needs still more work, and there will be a new draft on the ITF 76, which will be in November in Hiroshima. Then Wouter Vignatz presented the idea of trust history for local validating resolvers, which is especially useful like for laptops or local home users that have validating DNS resolvers, but they might be offline for a longer period of time and might miss some rollovers. So they need to have a way to pick up with their old data they already have, and the idea is to keep some kind of trust history, that is the old DNSSEC key somewhere, so that the resolvers can catch up and can forward to the current active DNSSEC keys there. This document has been accepted as a working group document, but it's not clear whether that will be in the DNS operations or DNS extensions working group. So that is still in discussion. Then we have something about DNS redirect, which copes about different ways of playing with DNS traffic in like man in the middle, what providers do, and also other parties might do, like legal enforcement agencies. This is not about making it like a standard document, also saying that DNS redirection is a good thing. It's more like if you need to do it, how to do it to do the least harm in the way. But still there was, as you can imagine, a lively discussion of whether not to do this, whether to write this in an RFC or just leave it outside the ITF. And then there's a new draft about DNSSEC policy statement framework. This draft is especially for people who need to write a DNSSEC policy in their organization. And this should be like a guidance document for people doing that. And another draft being there for how to populate the IP version 6 reverse tree automatically. As you might know, some ISPs today populate the IP version 4 reverse tree for their broadband customers, for the DSL customers, with just numbered names in there. That is not possible anymore in IP version 6 because it's just too much data. And this document here describes some ideas how to cope with that, like automatically synthesizing reverse entries in the IP version 6 reverse zones. So what else happened there besides the two working groups? There was an DNSSEC panel organized by ISOC, which was stuffed with Olaf Kochman, Patrick Wallström from the Swedish registry, Jim Galvin from Afilias talking about .org experience on DNSSEC signing, Matt Larson from VeriSign talking about the root zone signing. We have also heard that on Tuesday here, that it will be signed in 2009 and then officially available in 2010. Also, information was given out at that panel that .NET is being planned to be signed in 2010 and .com in 2011. And also Richard Lamb from ICANN was there and presented some of ICANN's idea about DNSSEC. And last but not least, there was Open DNSSEC pre-release in Stockholm. Open DNSSEC is an open source software for managing DNSSEC procedures. It's a quite interesting software if you need DNSSEC signing your zones and handle key rollovers and stuff. You can download that from opendnssec.org, and I would like to thank the Open DNSSEC team from here for their good software and also for the nice release party they gave in Stockholm. That's all from me. This is the links to the status pages from both working groups. One more thing. There's the Internet Dagarna in November in Stockholm, and on the 6th of November there's a full one-day DNSSEC, Open DNSSEC tutorial. So if you are interested in running Open DNSSEC in your networks and you want to get up to speed very easily, come to Stockholm on the 6th of November and there will be a one-day tutorial on this. So that's all from me. Thanks for listening.
Hi, are there any questions for Carsten?
This is Shane Kerr from ISC. I just wanted to point out that Alanz Duran's draft also includes a proposal to let ISPs know that they don't have to provide a reverse for IPv6 because it's not possible the way you do it today. So that was a somewhat contentious suggestion, but it may be interesting for people at the right meeting.
Yeah, thank you. It was not possible to cram everything in 10 minutes, yeah. So I had that on my list. But
okay, thank you very much. Thank you, Carsten. Okay, the next speaker is Dave Knight from ICANN, IANA, who is going to give us an update on IANA's ITAR and stuff of that nature.
Good morning. I'm Dave Knight. I work in the DNS operations group at ICANN. I'm giving this update this morning on behalf of Kim Davies from the IANA. He can't be here. So we started testing the ITAR in October 2008. It went live as a beta 3 months later. The ITAR only contains keying material for TLDs, so only those delegations which can in due course be secured in the signed root zone. TLD operators submit and remove the keys through the website at itar.iana.org. IANA staff then obtain consent for the changes from the admin and tech contacts listed in the root zone database. And once approved, the trust anchor will be published when it's in the listing period and there's a matching DNS key record visible in the TLD zone. There have been 61 change requests submitted. 42 trust anchors have been approved and listed. There are currently 20 TLDs listed in the ITAR. Five change requests were actually rejected by the domain contacts. Now, as far as we know, for those, it wasn't that people were trying to do bad things. They just recognized that they'd made a data entry mistake and later retried. Seven failed to respond in a timely way to the approval request. Approximately 10,000 downloads of the ITAR every month. Last week, there were, I think, 291 unique IP addresses pulled the ITAR. One of the more interesting observations we have from the past year is that some operators are managing to send us invalid trust anchors. It's good to see that the submission procedures and technical checks that are in place are catching these. This is going to be instructive to the process of forming DNS submission procedures for the signed root zone. In future, we want to add more proactive notifications, reminders of impended key listing period expiry, more useful debug information. Further, now that there's an actual date for signing the root, we should start thinking about the future of the ITAR, investigate decommissioning and things like that. These are resources permitting. Right now, of course, the priority is on getting the root signed. We're working on new procedures for DS record handling for the signed root zone. And because we have an existing root management procedure, and we can't just directly transplant the ITAR model to that. We'll be proposing the procedures for handling DS record submission to the root early next year. That's it for this update. Are there any questions?
Are there any questions for Dave? Yep.
The technical test you are doing, how far are they finished yet? Or on the ITAR?
Okay, I think that's going to be a question I'll have to defer to Kim.
Okay. So you know, because there's now one entry in the ITAR which doesn't make sense at all.
Okay.
So that's probably something you want to look at.
I can talk about it after and I can get that back to Kim.
Mark's got a question from Jabba.
I do. Roy Ahrens from Nominet asks, would it be possible for a TLD to submit a DNS key to IANA with the caveat that it does not enter the ITAR?
Again, I don't know. I'm going to have to take that back to Kim. Sorry.
Okay. Shane?
Hi, Shane Kerr, ISC. This may be another question for Kim, but you mentioned briefly decommissioning the ITAR. Is that a goal or?
There's currently no plan to do it, and I think we're eager to hear opinions from the community on how that should be handled, if it should be handled.
I think, from my own personal point of view, I'd prefer for the ITAR to remain indefinitely. I think it's a useful cross-check once the root is signed. So, thanks.
Peter?
I was trying to take this.
Who are you?
Oh, I'm sorry. Who am I? Peter Koch, sorry. Following up on what Shane just mentioned, we had this DNSSEC key task force set up here and came up with some ideas. Recommendation doesn't. It's findings these days about the how our TAR could look like and the exit strategy was mentioned there. And seeing the announcements and following this and actually liking the ITAR so far, There's also the question of tear down and exit strategy. Poisoning came up. So I think that's a key issue that needs to be addressed somehow, maybe open-ended with different opinions, but that actually makes it more important to discuss this, to have an exit strategy or not very early in the process, given that at, well, probably July 1st next year, people should know where to go and are not stuck with the ITAR when they should use the root zone or either way.
Sorry, I'm not sure if there was a question and then I was to respond to.
Please don't leave this dangling. Mm. I guess the exit strategy or the notion that there will not be one, that needs to be very carefully and early communicated.
Right, absolutely. And yes, certainly there will be lots of notice before any actual or when any actual decision is taken. And as I said, I think there's a lot of eagerness for input from the community on this.
Lars Lehmann from Autonomica, excuse me. Can I only strongly recommend that if you go for keeping the ITAR, please make sure that there's only one entry where you make updates so that you split the data in on your side so we don't have to make updates both to the ITAR and to the root in the future, because that is going, that's a recipe for mismatch.
Thanks.
Okay. Just before we close off this thing, Peter mentioned about the TAR task force that we set up roughly about a year ago. And we set a list of attributes and sort of suggestions of what kind of characteristics a trust anchor repository should look like. And broadly speaking, there's consensus inside the task force that the IANA ITAR meets those objectives and requirements. It's fairly closely matched with them. In fact, I think some of the documents that we produced, or the statements we produced, were very instrumental in helping Rick Lam and Kim actually do the initial work in specking out and scoping that ITAR that they did. Now, I think we're now at the point where we could probably say that the task force could declare victory and wind itself down. I think we're almost at that point. Now, I'm kind of trying to sort of jump ahead a little of the gun here, but I think it might be appropriate to not just wind up the task force just yet. It may be a good idea to have this Trust Anchor Repository Task Force continue, albeit in a sort of zombie state where it doesn't really do anything, but just keeping a track of what's happening with root signing and what's going to happen with the ITAR once the root is fully signed, and if there is going to be a transition and the ITAR does either get shut down or act as some kind of mirror of the signed root for whatever purposes. So I think it might be appropriate to sort of leave the task force in abeyance with the idea of just keeping an eye on the developments that might pop up over the next year to 18 months or so. Can I get a sense of a feel from the room if that seemed like a reasonable thing to do or not? See a few heads nodding and see most people pounding away on their keyboards. So I'll go with the usual rule that silence implies consent. So if you disagree with what I just suggested, scream now, please.
How loud do you want?
As loud as you like. Okay. Thank you very much, and thank you, Dave. Okay. Our next speaker is Stefan Bortsmeyer from AFNIC, who's going to give an update on his tools, which he's now collectively called DNS Witness. I'll keep an eye on time. I'll give you some.
Hello. So for those who were at the center meeting in Sunday, it's the same talk, so you can go to sleep right now. For those who were in Dubai at the DNS working group 1 year ago, there are the main difference in this talk is that I will mostly speak about the new passive monitor. And don't worry about the number of slides when you think of the length of the slot. I will skip most of the slides. So, okay. So the idea of DNS witness is a general term that we use to mention all our statistic and measurement tools. It has two important parts, an active monitor, which was presented in Dubai last year, and a passive one, which is the main subject of this talk. So, the active tool send DNS queries to see what's in the zone. For instance, do they have a quad A for www.thedomain? On the passive tools, well, it's just a TCP dump running on the name server and putting the data in a database for analysis. So this is the sort of thing that we can measure with the passive tool. A few things about practical problem. As you all know, if you try to put all the data from your name servers anywhere, it can take a lot of room. If you just TCP dump minus W all the requests to all your name servers, you will need a lot of disk, and to process it, you will need a lot of memory. So the most common solution is to use sampling. The general idea of DNS Witness is not to send the pickup files to a big factory somewhere with a lot of disk, a lot of power to process it. The idea is to move the program to the user, not the data to the analysis center, and then the user can perform his own analysis with his own data without having to send possibly sensitive data outside. That means that unless the person doing the analysis has a lot of machines, memory, etc., you will need sampling to process this data. Unless you are very rich, and in that case, you don't need to be here. Sampling, a good thing about the development of DNS Witness is that at the same time that we developed the program, the IETF in the PSAMP working group developed a set of RFC describing sampling, a framework for packet sampling, and general techniques for sampling, such as count-based sampling, time-based sampling, random sampling, etc., etc. So I strongly recommend to read at least RFC 5474. It's very interesting. Of course, nothing is perfect in the world. There is no free lunch. If you use sampling, you will have sampling errors. If you remember the university when the teacher talked about statistics, error bars, standard deviation, etc., it's the time to read your old university books again. Also, sampling has a limit, has a serious limit when it comes to security. If you want to track a phenomenon which is uncommon, for instance, DNS attacks with dynamic update on bind in July of this year, you could tear down, with this attack, it was possible to tear down a name server with just one packet. If you do sampling, you may miss this packet. So if you want to do security studies, sampling is probably not appropriate. Okay, now what we do, what we developed. So DNS Mezzo, it's the name of the passive component of DNS Witness, has three parts. One is to do the capture. We use a pickup dump, a program written at ISC, but you could use anything, TCP dump, DNS cap, etc. Then a dissector which takes the data, the pickup files, put them in the database, and then we use a set of reporting programs using SQL to query the database. I skip most of the slides about implementation for lack of time, but just remember, if you do it yourself or if you assign a student to write a dissector for pickup files, remember that it is very dangerous because in the real world, many, many packets in the file are badly formed. You find a lot of funny things. For instance, for the DNS, you can find a name compression pointer that goes outside of the packet. So if you blindly follow it, you will have a buffer overflow or something like that. So be careful. Okay, more interesting, we put everything in a DBMS, in a SQL DBMS. The main reason being that everyone knows SQL, everyone is able to do SQL requests, even people at our marketing department. That's true in our case. And it makes analysis easier. You don't have to write a program for each analysis. Of course, if you are ambitious, you can do it not with SQL, but with MapReduce algorithm, with the Adobe software, things like that. But for us today, we use only boring, ordinary SQL. Here are are examples of some SQL requests. For instance, if you want to find the non-existing domains that are requested, it's funny information, you simply select domain where the domain field from the packets when it is not a query and when the response code is 3, meaning NX domain. Let's skip the performance issues. And let's move to the results. One of the goals of the DNS witness system was to make long-term surveys, the ability to study things over not only several months, but also several years. That's one more reason to use sampling, because we cannot keep the whole flow of data for many years. But for this talk, I will not be able to show you long-term studies because it's too recent. DNS Mezzo at AFNIC is only seriously running since April, May, something like that. So what we do at the current time, we sample at 1%, random. We take a collection during 24 hours. Unfortunately, we have only one name server which is instrumented at this time. It's on the to-do list to add more. And we capture with pickup dump. Now, the results. Every wipe talk starts with information about IPv6. So I will do like everyone else. What is the percentage of IPv6 requests on .fr name servers? And at present time, 0.6%. Remember that an authoritative name server, what we manage, only see recursors, typically bind name servers located at ISP, local networks, etc. So 0.6 does not tell us nothing about the desktop machines which are behind. It's only the percentage of resolvers in France that have IPv6. It will be interesting in the future to see if it increases. I'll come back later with more data at the next wipe meeting. It will be a good opportunity to ask for a new trip. Interestingly, many of the other statistics do not seem to depend on IPv6 versus IPv4. If you remember the talk by Google at Dubai, at the wipe meeting in Dubai, they observed more IPv6 use during the weekend, because probably users have more IPv6 connectivity at home than at work. We did not see yet any correlation between the percentage of IPv6 on anything. For instance, clients which are not patched against the Kaminsky vulnerability, which do not have SPR, source port randomization, they have the same percentage of V4 versus V6. My hypothesis was that IPv6 clients were managed by people more intelligent, more clever, more serious, etc. It does not seem to be the case. Of course, when the percentage is so low, 0.6, you don't need to be a god in statistics to infer that you have to be very careful when you interpret anything. Another funny measurement is the size of the response that we send. Here you can find on the x-axis the date, so it started in May of this year. On the y-axis, the percentage of requests per size. The big one, the green one, is between 128 bytes and 255. It's the most typical size. As you can see from the numbers, we don't sign .fr with DNSSEC. Once we do, the figures will change a lot. That's the idea. It's to be able to measure it in the long term. You can have a very similar picture with DSC. If you use a very good DSC program, you can have a snapshot of the activity on your name servers, and you can have, among all the statistics that DSC can do, you can have a very similar picture. The interesting thing about DNS Mezzo is, since we store everything in the database, we can do this sort of survey even in the past, even far away in the past, as far away as we have enough hard disk to store it. Another typical survey that it is interesting to do with DNS Mezzo is the most popular domain.
It was an actual question from the management. What are the most important .fr domains? Important being not easy to define, of course. It seems a very simple question. But, oh, by the way, it also, you can also do it with DSC, but this is an option that you have to activate and which slows down DSC a lot, so we don't use it. Because when you manage an authoritative name server, you don't see the actual requests sent by the users, but the requests sent by the DNS resolvers at the ISP. So it may change the picture a lot. What we saw that the most popular domain in .fr were infrastructure domains, domains which are used for hosting name servers, domains that you can find on the right-hand side of NS records. So, for instance, no one knows magic.fr, but there are many, many domains in .fr with a name server, ns1.magic.fr, ns2.magic.fr. So it's one of the most popular domains far away of the content domain, like google.fr, microsoft.fr, sncf.fr, etc. Of course, the most popular domain of everything is nick.fr, because it's the one we use to name all name servers. So the management asked us very simple questions. What are the most popular domains? And they got a reply of 20 pages detailing all the possible answers. Another interesting study is to see, are we better now with respect to the Kaminsky vulnerability? Are all the name servers patched at last to have source port randomization? No. 18% of the big clients, I say big clients because we don't take into account small resolvers, resolvers that IP address that send only one or two or three requests. To be among this clients, you need to send 1,000 requests in 24 hours, which is not so bad, and still 18% of these clients still do not have SPR. And they are not only small and unmanaged resolvers, because together they make 15% of the requests. So we still have a lot of work to do here. Yes?
Just immediate question. If you've just filtered... I am Daniel. If you filter on just the pure number of requests, you might get skewed by misbehaving resolvers, right? That keep asking the same question. Did you filter that out?
No, we don't filter this. What we filter out are things like recursive requests, because we see a lot of recursive requests which are not bind resolvers, which are typically students running dig in a tight loop, this sort of thing. But we... Some of the other possible treatments are not done yet. Also, of course, in the short time of this presentation, I cannot describe all the methodology, which is often a problem. Yes.
No, I understand that. Just a suggestion, if you just look at the sheer number, you might not filter out some stuff you want to filter out.
For some of the worst offenders, I checked every request that they made to see if it was a typical resolver behavior. And in some cases, I warned the owner, I tried to find the IP address in the RIPE database, and then I sent email, phone call, etc. Most of the time, of course, I got no reply, but it's another matter. Okay, almost the last. This one is about the query type, A, record, NS, MX. Basically, what you can see from it is that all the nice types, resource record types that are invented by IETF, SRV, NAPTR, etc., are not used a lot in the real world. Most of the requests are still for the good old A and MX. The reason why the curve is moving is because MX is very influenced by spam campaigns. Each time there is a big spam campaign, we see a lot more MX requests. And then it comes back to normal. Okay. I don't have the time to have a detailed comparison with other systems, but don't worry, we studied other possible systems. Of course, the one which is closest from DNS Mezzo is the one by our Swedish colleagues, DNS2DB. So if you plan to install such a system on your network, It's not only for TLD. It can be used by anyone who manages DNS servers. You have to consider this too. They are nice competitors. One last thing. Of everything is distributed under free software license at www.dnswitness.net. I skip on future work, but in Dubai last year, I promised to come back with longer-term trends about the active monitor this time, DNS Delve. And here are the results for IPv6-enabled domains in .fr. What we do is we take every domain in .fr and we ask them about things like www.thedomain, do you have a quad A? And we check the MX, is one of the MX as a quad A. So the blue, the pale blue curve is the number of domains with at least one name server with a quad A. Here. This. You can see a survey going from December 2008 to now. This seems to be very good for IPv6 because the number of domains with at least one IPv6 name server goes to less than 2% to more than 7%. Unfortunately, we see it only for name servers. For web servers or for MX, we don't see such an increase. And for the case of MX, there is even a decrease of the number of IPv6-enabled domains for unknown reasons yet. But I'm sure I will have questions about it. So I'll stop the talk now. Questions welcome.
Thank you, Stefan. Any questions for Stefan? Any questions? Okay, I guess we're done. Thank you very much. Okay, next up we have Ed Lewis, who's going to talk about some issues around about provisioning of key signing keys and secure entry points. Ed's actually got an updated slide, so I'm going to try.
When I'm watching the Exodus as I get up to the stage. I have a. I gave the title of this slide originally to Jim, saying what would operators do about provisioning DNSSEC, and I forgot I had that really good title. So I had written the slides with topics DNSSEC operations, SCP provisioning. Now, Jim also said I had a very small time slot. I wanted to get these slides out with a lot of background material, so people who are not that familiar with the situation can kind of read back in some definitions of what an SCP is, what a TAR is, and all these other terms that we see floating around a lot. So I'm going to just go through the slides I have written down on the bottom. That's why I updated the slide set, so they could just skip to the points. We need a standard in this area. We've had a lot of failures in the last year in terms of the DLV and the TAR, and people are saying, you know, things are out of date. Things are not working as they are today, and part of the problem, I believe, is because we don't have a standard way of sending SCP keys, these KSKs, around. We're losing track of what's going out there. Part of it is the producers of this don't know where the receivers are and so on, and the receivers aren't keeping up to date, and there's no timing. We just don't have any one way of doing this. And I really think we need a standard if we really want this to grow, because without standards, we only have those who know each other play along. We want to get this beyond that stage. One problem I have, a slide I'm skipping, is I worked in a company that both does a registry where we take in these keys from our customers eventually, but we also run a DNS hosting service where we have to give the keys out to other registries, and we don't even have a good solid way to talk among within the company right now. We can do it, but we want to do it the same way for everybody else. We don't want to have just our own little internal pipe. So I'm going to go into the situation where I'm just trying to change the SEP, and this is an approach. There's a scenario that I started thinking about, which is I have a running zone, and I want to go to the next KSK or SEP key. So I need to swap this. And the problem I have is the swap part. When I want to tell the parent of my zone I have a new SEP key, I want to be able to say, here is the key, and then first of all, get a feedback saying that they heard me, and also like to know that they actually are going to, that they enact the change. I need to know that the change has actually happened at the upper, at the top, in their area. And what I would need to address here is the security of this. I don't want the parent to just accept any keys from anybody. They have to get it from the right place and the right in the right time, or you know, basically when you know it's coming. But also service level is, if I'm in an emergency, I would need to have this done fairly quickly, and what's my envelope? What's the amount of time I must allocate for the response when I'm doing my rollover plans? RC 5011 is trust anchor management, which sounds like this should actually just do what I want. The problem is it doesn't have a confirmation step. It has a way for the producer of the keys to say, here's a key coming, take a look at it. If no one complains in a month, you can kind of count on it. But then when I revoke it, you want to get rid of it. But there's never any confirmation that those listening to you are going to do the revocation and so on and move on, because this is an open-ended situation they're trying to solve. Now, to try to give a graphical look at what I see as the problem is that when I start out with a KSK or a SEP, a brand new one, I am going to publish it in my system first, from my provisioning side down to where I do lookups. I then want to explicitly tell the parent I am now using this key. I want them to know that this is not by implication. I want you to know I am now going to this next secure entry point. Now, the way of telling the parent could also be through a lookup in the DNS, but I really don't want to get into a solution. I really want to have an explicit notification goes to the parent, like, this is the change. The next thing is the parent or the TAR, whatever I'm talking to, has to process that new record, whether they sign it and put it in the zone or they distribute it through whatever mechanism they do. The next step is it's confirmed that I've seen that all those I've told about the key now have all changed the key. So now on my end, I can go to the next step, which is to get rid of the old key. That's basically the what I envision as the flow of the data. Let's skip ahead to slide 18. Oops, it is slide 18, 21. So that I see is the data flow problem. The situation we run into is trying to solve this. We run into the usual debate about there are so many ways people have interfaces between those who run websites, those who run DNS for them, those who register names in the registries, how registries are put together. We have the ICANN model. We have everybody else's model. And I tried to break these boxes out here. And what I see is this is the generalized model. This is not necessarily going to identify the flows. But we have to figure out how this works. And I have slides in here that I'm not showing, which are like playing around with what I think is actually in play in places, some of the ICANN model and so on. We have the blue arrows kind of are somewhat solved. The right-hand blue arrow in some places is the EPP protocol. Again, that's not everyone's flavor. The green dashed arrows are the things that I think we need to solve. How do we get the data that comes from operating the DNS into the parent or the TARs? And I don't mean necessarily directly, but we got to get the data through all the pipes to get over there. And I want to remind people, this is about provisioning data. This is not lookups. I like to make sure that we get this data into the provisioning side of the house, whether it's those who check things at Trust Anchor repositories or it's the registries going through their database and so on. So we have to get this through the provisioning side of this. And these are the requirements. This is what I really want to come up with at some point. I'm not saying these are all the requirements, but these are what I think we have to solve. We have to do the functionality. We have to make sure we get this data back and forth, whether it's a swap or a add, modify, delete of the DS record in all the other places. Security's got to be there. We have to make sure that only the authorized folks are getting authenticated changes made. Accountability, if the changes are being made and things have fallen on the floor, how do we go back and clean things up? Performance, for me, is important because when I'm designing my plans, I need to know how long I have to wait before the parent and everybody else will say they've made the swap of the key. And finally, predictable. Predictability in operations is a really good thing, that everybody knows it's coming and it comes on time. If when things aren't predictable, we start getting suspicious that maybe there is some malicious activity out there or just a plain failure. Now, the environments, this is where we get hung up a lot of time in mail list discussions. There are a whole lot of ways to set this up here. There's the registrant to registry with their own operators of DNS and so on. I just want to say that we have all these environments out there. The slides that you'll see in the slide pack have different drawings that were just me trying to attempt expanding what the problem space is. It's not just also domain names. It's also the reverse map, too. The LIRs and their reverse map information going back to RIPE and so on. All of this is, we have the same problem up and down the tree, no matter how we've divided up the business models of how we put things together. So go to the last slide I'm going to use is, ultimately, what I'm looking for now is I want to come up with requirements because we need to have a standard to do this stuff. We need to have a good way to pass things back and forth that works across the board. When you're an operator of DNS and you're producing DS records, I have to talk to many registries out there. If I'm a registry out there, I have to talk to many operators out there, and I have to talk to them in different ways. We operate registries in according to ICANN model sometimes, CCT model other times. We have lots of different modes of operation, so we want to solve this in a way that everyone can kind of come to some level of agreement between where do we put the interfaces, between the DNS operator and the registry model and so on. And also, what I didn't put in these slides here, because initially I was going to include this, but we also need to talk about the ISPs running recursive name servers. They need to get the SCP key, principally for the root zone and maybe other zones too. And so I'm interested in talking to people who are running ISP recursive servers and how they want to get involved with this. In addition to anyone who has an environment that may not be the ICANN shared registry model, that's the one I'm familiar with, and find out what do we need, where do we need to solve this, and hopefully also get people to think about this problem. Some people have actually talked to me that they hadn't thought about this part of the provisioning until the questions have come up here. So with that, done with my slides.
Thank you. Any questions for Ed?
This is Shane Kerr again, still from ISC. I don't disagree with anything you say, Ed. I think this is good, and I think it's a good activity going forward. One thing that I do worry a little bit about is, do you think that any kind of standard process or technology can succeed without registrar buy-in?
No. Actually, someone pointed out that the reason why we have this problem is in the ICANN world, the registrar to registrant interface really isn't, there's no standard there at all.
Right.
So, yeah. In fact, one of the slides I have there is we may have to push this data into the registrars and then they put it into EPP and what they know. But the registrars too are, the thing for me, there are registrars who are domain name operators also, and there's registrars who are just domain name sellers. And I don't touch that part of the market, so I'm not that familiar. That's why I want to hear from people who are in there, what do they feel is the, what do they want to see? Do they want to run on a protocol? How do they want to handle this?
I guess I think it would be worthwhile going through the activity, even if it fails, because it can succeed in some subset of cases. Yeah. But I suspect that the registrars are going to say no, and basically make DNSSEC adoption very tricky.
Yeah, I'm sure maybe some will make it easier, some will make it harder. We've talked to some registrars who are a lot more advanced in doing DNSSEC because they do a whole hosting thing, and they have a little different interpretation. They have an easier problem, frankly, because they can go right to the the registry.
Have you talked with, I think Steve Crocker is working on the problem of transfers between, okay.
Yeah, that actually one of the slides I missed was related problems.
Okay,
that, so.
Okay.
Yeah, I actually, listening to a presentation they gave made me say we need to understand what the problem is. So.
Patrick?
Patrick Feldstrom. I'm standing here as one, as a registrar in .se. One of the things that I think you should think about carefully regarding registrars is whether you envision the the manager or the holder of the keys of the child's own talking directly to the registry or to the registrars. And that might be that sort of business case implication mm-hmm. is something which might be the biggest sort of reaction yeah. by the registrars. Mm-hmm. The second thing is that there is, in general, a need for a protocol to communicate with the registrar, given that you're a DNS manager, because you might yeah. want to do other changes than change the DS. It might be the case that you want to also provision a zone, or it might be the case that you want to change the NS and whatnot. Yeah. And the question is whether you would like to go down the path of actually implementing the whole EPP baggage. Yeah. Maybe you don't want to do that. Yeah. So I think if it is the case, that but I do think that this discussion in the DNSSEC context might be able to move forward if we try to constrain it as a discussion on how should a DNS operator that is not a registrar pass the DS record to the registrar of the domain.
Well, that's one subcase.
That's absolute yeah. subcase, yeah. but maybe it is the case that we sort of, by also constraining the problem, it might be easier to move forward also from sort of a business case perspective to get a buy-in on yeah. the whole idea.
Yeah, I think the reason why this question came up earlier is NS records aren't as suddenly... When you change an NS record, you can add one and keep going. With DS records, if you change that, you could cut your... That's why this is coming up now as opposed to before.
Matt?
Hi, Matt Larson. I really want to follow up mostly to something Shane said, because he hit one of my hot buttons, which is that this talk of special actions for transfers of DNSSEC-enabled domains, that's not a registry and a registrar issue. That's an issue between two hosting providers. Now, I know that sometimes the registrar is the hosting provider, but that does not mean that we need to encumber the registrar-registry relationship with that. A transfer is a transfer, and the DS record, the key material, goes from one domain to the other. We're done.
Yeah,
Lars Lehmann, Autonomic again. But that implies, depending on Lars, what Matt said, that implies that we need to really clearly define the role of the DNS operator in this all these series yeah. of relationships. And you might need to define protocols to deal with that matter from deal with the DNS operator. It may not hit the registry, it may not hit the registrar, but that there is probably room for improvement in that section.
Okay. Yeah,
certainly, if I have someone as .com, I'm not going to send it to VeriSign. I'm going to send it to their registrar. But if I have someone who's in CCTLD that has a direct interface, I want to send it right there. Yep. I know that I'm not going to send anything right to .com for my customers who are .com delegations. So.
Okay. Ed, I've got a final question just to close this off, which I actually think there's going to be two questions. One is for yourself and perhaps one for the working group. And the question is, what do you think the next steps are here? I think you've identified something that needs to be tackled. And it doesn't look as if it fits comfortably in something that would be done at the IETF, because it doesn't just deal with EPP-type activities, and it's not really a DNS issue per se that would fit with DNSSOC or DNSX. So there probably needs some kind of forum to do this, and maybe this is something maybe this working group might want to pick up on, but I'd like to know what you think maybe the next steps you'd like to see, and maybe if the working group fixes maybe something that, yes, this is a work item that we can maybe pick up and do something with.
Yeah, I picked this venue to present this for a couple of reasons. One is the IETF is about protocols and solutions, not about requirements so much. This also is the kind of thing that if I were to pick between IETF and ICANN, I'd go to ICANN, but this isn't an ICANN-only problem. I want to reach out to people that have other operations models that are beyond the ICANN model. ICANN model is one part of this. We need to get more voices. And also, this may actually touch on the recursive server side, which is the ISPs that may be coming to RIPE, and have another angle on DNSSEC completely, where they need to pull this data out and provision it in their recursive servers. So this is the venue, I think, that where people have the broadest spectrum, at least in this area, in the European area, that you give a better perspective on how you run this entire system. And we all have unique ways of doing things. We have, you know, SE has the experience of running this for some time. That's why I think handling this issue in this group is a good place to go. I mean, I might go to some place in Asia, APTLD, and look at theirs, but then that's only registries. I really like the fact we have operators in the room and the registries and everything in one area here. So I think this is a good venue for that. We think we have a good cross discussion here. now. So the next thing is, does it work group?
Yeah, is this something that the working group is minded that we could maybe pick up and do something with? My feeling might be is that maybe the might forward is, if we want to do something here, is maybe to have Ed produce a paper or something that we could then start chewing on and then refining and then working on with a view to, say, creating an action item later on. I think it's too early to start talking about action items myself personally, but I think this is something we might want to take up. Peter?
Okay, so first I should state, even though I was out of the room most of the time, I've read the slides before, so I partly know what I'm talking about, hopefully. I have the slight concern that we are discussing this topic in too many fora already. Having more discussion on the mailing list is fine, but I personally don't see, and probably no hats in this case, I don't see anything that the working group could do better than other fora. So we have various ITF venues, and well, you're in a bad shape anyway when you prefer ICANN over ITF, right?
but
we have the DNSSEC deployment working group. We have other things. I don't really see what this working group could add to that. From that perspective, what's needed here is operators and registrars. And if we do have them in the room, then yeah, please speak up and take up the work and share your concerns.
Okay.
Actually, do you want to ask the question? Who's operators? Who's registrars?
No, we're out of time. No other questions or comments on this. Well, I think what we do is leave it as at the moment. I think have some more discussion on the list and see if something materials out of the list that then could be something either for the working group to do or to pass on to one of these other fora that Peter was mentioning. I think that's probably the best part.
And if anyone wants to send something to me privately, that's fine too. I'm just trying to collect data that you want to give me.
Okay. Thanks very much, Ed. Okay. Next slot is set aside for follow-ups to EOF discussions, and I've tried to split this into two for the agenda for the working group today. So we would like to have discussion in this closing slot before the lunch break around the route signing initiative that Matt and Joe outlined in the EOF plenary on Tuesday, and also any follow-up questions to the DNSSEC deployment plans that Sarah discussed for .pt. So Matt, I know, has got a couple of slides ready for just going into a bit more of the technical detail about the route signing plans. But before we get on to that, I would just like to say, is there anybody got any follow-up questions on plans for signing.pt or any other issues surrounding that? Sarah, do you have anything to say at this point? No? Okay, then. Well, we've got a few minutes for slide presentation of sort, but this is really just to spark discussion, and hopefully we can have discussion up until we get to lunch break about the overall year. I'll now shut up and leave it to Joe and Matt.
Okay, so I'm going to... I'm Joe Abley, this is Matt Larson. I'm going to skip through these fairly quickly. On Tuesday, we mentioned this in overview, so the idea here was to have a bit more of a closed session where people could ask questions. What we're trying to do is deploy a signed route, all these good attributes. So the problems that we think we have, the issues that we are trying to accommodate when we deploy a signed route, first of all, we think that we don't exactly know how many, but we think a reasonably large number, a number large enough to not be able to ignore, of clients set DO equals 1, even when they have no intention of validating. So that's currently working fine when they receive a small unsigned response, but when they receive a large signed response, it's possible that the network between that DNS client and the server will not accommodate the response, and that could be because of UDP fragmentation issues, because of TCP transport availability, it could be because of firewalls or other middleware that are not expecting big responses. So if we suddenly start sending big responses to all those clients that currently, with no changes, are receiving smaller responses, it's possible those clients will suddenly stop being able to see name servers, and we think that's probably bad. The other issue that we're trying to accommodate is that if there is some catastrophe midway through the rollout of DNSSEC, which requires us to roll back, and if that catastrophe happens far enough down the line that a validator community has appeared, early adopters who have decided to validate from the root down, If we unsigned the root zone, that looks like a man-in-the-middle attack, and the DNS goes dark for those people. So in that case, by unsigning to protect the people who are not ready for DNSSEC, we're hurting the people who are ready. And this has, you know, bad connotations for future deployment. So the two aspects to our proposal here, first of all, we want to deploy incrementally. So we're talking about deliberate incoherence in the structure of the zone, not the contents of the zone, not the glue or the NS records or the SOA serial numbers. But we want to serve a signed zone from an increasing number of servers, but not all the servers, gradually increasing to be all the servers. So to start with, we'd serve a signed zone from just LROOT, which is the root server operated by ICANN. We'd follow up with one hosted with JROOT. Other root servers would then pick up the signed zone in some sort of published schedule, and we expect the last one we would do would be A. And the timeline for this would be months. So the idea here is that we have name servers which have problems receiving a large response, but which are able to shift and reuse a different name server if they can't reach the one they tried to start with, then those name servers are somewhat protected in the sense that they still have some name servers they can use to get a small response that's small enough for them to receive. And we leave A till last because we think there is some population of clients in the world which do a linear search or which always assume that A is reachable. So that's, that amount of damage we'll leave till last. The second important aspect is that when we sign the zone, we will do it in such a way that you cannot validate the records in it. So the idea of doing this is we prevent a community of early adopting validators from forming simply because the data in the zone doesn't support validation. The key that we put in the DNS key set will be a key that's not used to sign anything, and the key that's used to sign things will not be published anywhere. So there's no trust anchor available for this. There's no validation possible. And here's an example of a bogus key we might put in the DNS key set at the apex. So it contains some text. This is actually a valid key, but it contains some text that it guides people as to why they shouldn't use it. So again, the goals here are to deploy conservatively and to prevent a community of validators from forming. So doing all this stuff is very nice, but unless we measure, there's not much point in doing it. So the idea here is to do two kinds of measurement. One is actual examination of the packets on those root name servers that are well instrumented to see if we can identify trends in traffic changes, see if we can find communities of clients which are shifting from one server to another in response to that server serving a signed zone. We expect this to be a somewhat difficult problem because the root servers receive an awful lot of crap, so it's difficult to see amongst all the crap exactly what's good. And the other important part is to keep talking to operators and let them know these changes are happening and to try and receive feedback through mailing lists and meetings and such things as to what impact in the real world these actions at the root are having. So before we'd start any of this, of course, we would make sure that the proposal we have doesn't fundamentally break any well-known implementation of a resolver in terms of the way it's signed. And we're here basically to get some feedback on this. This is a proposal at this stage. We're proposing that this would start as of December the 1st. It would continue towards full deployment next year. So it's coming fairly soon. If people have opinions about whether this is a good idea or a bad idea, we'd like to hear them. And if we have all additional time for questions, if people have other questions from Tuesday to do with parameters used to sign the route or anything else, you can also ask them here or approach Matt or I directly.
Okay then. Time for questions and comments. Who would like to take the mic first? Ed.
Yeah, okay. Ed Lewis, Newstar. The DIRS and the incoherency, how do you see them in time? The incoherency would be good before you give out the real keys, I would think. But do you think you might give out the real keys before you get to all the servers? Or have you thought about the timing of the two?
I think the way we envision this is that the end of this whole process, once the signed zone, the unvalidatable zone, has been rolled out everywhere, is that we would then execute the first production KSK roll. And that process, as part of that process, we don't publish the trust anchor until the auditors and all the security validation has happened that the processes were carried out completely. So there really is no key to hand out until that KSK roll has happened.
Shane?
Shane Kerr, ISC.
I have a question about the physical locations where L and J are served from. Are they both Anycast around the world?
I'm sorry, about which servers?
About the you're starting off with the L server. And, well, my thinking is that you may have different impacts depending on where the servers are physically located. So it looked from the slide as if you're starting with L and then going to J and then everyone else but A. And I just want to make sure that you're actually covering the same regions of the world when you go from that step after J to everyone but A.
I don't immediately see the connection with Anycast. I mean, fundamentally, it's an IP address of a root server that's providing service.
But clients tend to go to the closer root server. So I guess what I would propose is that to try to get the root servers that are widely distributed geographically as a kind of next level of things that could possibly break.
So. Okay. Olaf?
Yeah, Olaf Kolkman, Nelnet Labs. The sorts of hooks into what Shane just mentioned, in the order in which you deploy all this, because I think that order has to do with what kind of problems you are anticipating and what measurement methods you are using to try and observe if those problems actually occur. It might be that, and this is something that I think is the heart of my comment/question. There might be things that are very hard to observe, problems that are very hard, that occur but are very hard to observe because traffic patterns shift. The traffic patterns are in the noise of what is actually happening on root servers and so on and so forth. So I'd be interested in understanding what kind of things you will be looking for and what kind of methodology you will be using for observing those shifts. And whether there are any plans to share those methodologies and possible problems you are looking for with the broad community.
Okay, I'll start from the last part of your question first. The intent here is that all documentation, all designs about the system are going to be made public, and that will include the testing plan and the deployment. So not only made public, but made public and we're soliciting feedback. I agree that measuring is a real problem for all the reasons you said. It's difficult because it's finding a needle in the haystack. One of the things we're going to do, in addition to looking at just the obvious stuff like raw query load and the pattern of source IPs that query a given server, someone suggested that we could look at the number of queries that come in with an EDS buffer, EDNS 0 buffer size of 512. If that number goes up, that could indicate people falling back because they were unable to get large responses. The other thing that we're relying on, as Joe said in the slide, is community feedback. What we really don't say in these slides is that the communication plan that goes along with this is going to be widely published. We want everybody to know that this is going to be going on, and we're going to have multiple feedback channels. And the intent is to have there be some time while the unvalidable, or have there be an interval between when the last server is serving the unvalidatable zone until we publish the real trust anchor. So there will be a window when all the servers are in this mode. So if there's somebody who has trouble, there's no place they can go. And that's sort of the time of last resort to accept feedback and find out from people if there are problems.
Daniel?
Daniel Kahnberg. I think this is a neat idea, just to start on the positive side, because nobody has said this yet. Yeah. So I think this is a neat idea. I also think, and it may sound somewhat redundant because of what you just last said, but I stood up earlier. I think the crux of this whole thing is the communications. I think I would be very worried if it wasn't, you know, if there wasn't a strong, unified communication plan between all the actors in this area that projects A, exactly what's going to happen, projects B, what the motivation is, and that it is not sort of arbitrary playing with the system. And C, would projects very clearly that we're all acting in a coordinated way, and that we're all behind this, and that it's all well organized. And I think that is about 95% of the effort. And I see both of you standing there with ICANN and VeriSign hats on, and I appreciate you taking the lead on this, but I think you have to have everyone in this space be part of that communications plan and have a unified message going out so that this cannot be spun as something that's bad or destabilizes the system and so on. So I think the ducks you have to line up are not just the technical execution plan, the measurement plan, which is very important because you have to take measurements from various places. I mean, we have structures for that, but the important thing is to have the communications plan lined up. Those ducks are the most important ducks in this one.
Thank you, Daniel. Andrei?
Andrei Robachevsky, RIPNCC. I guess my question is very similar to what Olaf asked, and in particular, well, better understanding what kind of can break this communication between root service and the clients from the client perspective. Because I appreciate that we as root operators will look after what's happening with the traffic patterns and how this whole thing behaves, but it's very difficult to detect problems on the client side. You may experience some more delays or something like that, but I doubt that people will go deeper and analyze. So my question here, how can we aid the clients so they can test where they're having problems and get them more explicitly than just by, you know, shifting to other letters that are not signed yet?
I think that's a good question. I don't know that we have a particularly clever answer for it right now. The clients we're talking about, of course, are the validators that are run by the ISPs. So as far as the communication that Daniel was talking about, the key audience for this seems to be the ISP communities, the people who are running the help desks, people who have things to check for when clients are complaining that resolvers don't work. Now, there are some big recursive resolver operators that we can probably pay special attention to, the David Ulovich's OpenDNS and such people, and we can try and talk to them and find out what their experiences are as a key example of a well-used resolver. But as far as giving clients better tools to try and find out what's going on, communication and having people debug their own services seems like the most immediate path. I mean, if people have more ideas about specific kinds of tests, I know there are some people working on client-oriented tests to test PathMTU for DNS queries and such things.
Yeah.
I think that's great, and I think continuing to hear feedback from those people is important. But again, that seems more like a communications channel issue for us at the moment.
Yeah, I guess my suggestion was to, along with a communication campaign, give people real tools so they can check whether it's their firewall or they might have like fragmentation on the path or something else related to actual data that we're serving.
No, it's a good idea.
Okay. We do, coming up very close to the end of our allotted slot, and I think we should have continued discussion as much as we possibly can. But let's not enter too much into the time, so could I ask the remaining speakers to please try to be as brief and as direct in their comments and questions so we can fit everybody in. Neil.
Neil O'Reilly, University College Dublin. Part of what I wanted to ask was already asked by Andre, but I think there are still a few gaps here. On the one hand, it's not just about tools, but the question is, The outward communication, I think, has been very clearly identified as needing to be done, but the problem is the feedback channel. How is, for example, the help desk in my university or the ISP that delivers service back to my home going to be not just able to communicate back any problems, but seriously brought into the channel? Because when I'm hearing, it's all very well to hear people with problems should let us know, but there has to be a much more positive outreach than that, and it's a huge challenge. And I'm not sure if there are any good answers for that. But if you have some, it would be good to hear them.
When we have some, we'll let you know.
It's not quite that bad. We do have some ideas.
Sarah from FCCN. I just have two questions. One, I didn't notice if you have already plans on use NSEC or NSEC 3 and why. And the other one is as a .pt. I think someone already asked it at plenary, but I really would like to know. As .pt, if I want to submit my DS, do you have any kind of validation or digital certification, something that will guarantee that it's really the .pt that is in the DS record?
Sure. So for the first question, it'll be NSEC, not NSEC 3. The root zone is a public zone. We don't have any need to enforce privacy in the root zone, so it'll be NSEC. As to the second question, that's really an IANA question. And I don't work with the IANA group at ICANN, so I can't give you a very good answer at this stage. But the existing channels that are used to authenticate requests to change entries in the root zone, for instance, if you change name servers or if you renumber name servers, those procedures will be extended to accept DS data to be used as trust anchors in the root zone. And the precise mechanisms by which you do that, I don't believe have been fully defined yet. So that's an ongoing work item for the IANA. Once those have been received and those get authorized by the NTIA as part of the normal chain of deployment of data for the root zone from IANA through NTIA to VeriSign. So as far as the overlap between the root zone and the ITAR goes, there's no desire at this stage, at least nobody has expressed desire to the IANA, as far as I know, to have any records automatically moved from the ITAR to the root zone. It will require some explicit requests to have things added rather than... Nothing automatic will happen. It will be driven by the TLDs.
Johan?
Johan Rehn, Autonomica. I have two comments. Comment number one is that you said that receiving larger responses may cause problems for certain resolvers because they, for one reason or another, will not be able to receive it, be it broken middleware or whatever. I think it's useful to clarify a bit that we actually have a fair amount of DNSSEC already in the system here. So those people with that general problem will probably have certain issues with reaching a whole bunch of TLDs, including .org right now. So I don't think that's really a major issue. It's a concern, but not a major issue, because it has mostly been, if not flushed out, then at least already noticed. The really crucial difference here is the priming query. The priming query is the only thing that is different when signing the root compared to signing all sorts of other sounds. So that's worth keeping in mind somewhere. That's the real difference. Then on the topic of stats and measurements and seeing if there are troubles, well, I absolutely have concerns here. I see that noise daily. I've spent weeks and months trying to understand the noise. I've given up, mostly. It's really, really hard to analyze root server traffic, even if you have many of them. It's not easier by having all of them, because then we'll get into data collation issues that are hard by themselves. So I believe there will be certain problems with actually seeing stuff in this. And then we have the additional problem being that when you ask for input from the community when there are problems, the real problem here is that the community, as in us, are not the ones who will have problems. the people who should tell us something are the guys we've never heard of. And the problem with the guys we've never heard of is that if they have a problem with this, for whatever reason, in spite of all the announcements, DNS is not working as it should, the most typical response on the edge of the network is to restart the name server. And this, unfortunately, sort of further messes up the stats, because the assumption here is that a resolver that has a problem trying to, for instance, prime against a signed letter will go to the next one, which may be signed, will go to the next one, and eventually find an unsigned one, and it's fine. The problem is that when you restart the name server or reboot the machine or whatever, you lose all context and you lose all history. So it will just start out from the same vantage point again, doing the same broken thing over again. And this even further makes the stats hard to interpret.
May I respond to this?
Joe, Matt, do you want to say anything first? No?
Olaf Kolkman again, and Nelnet Labs. What you just explained was at the basis of the question that I asked earlier. I believe that if you try to assess what kind of things can go wrong, and what you just mentioned is the thing that can go wrong, people restarting their name service, I think that you could come up with a specific footprint of that behavior. And then data mining for that footprint might be much easier to do sampling or whatever. And my suggestion would be try to come up with scenarios of things that can go wrong. Things that you just mentioned is only one scenario. And try to see if you what kind of footprint you would see in the data to a collective set of name servers and see if you can tailor your measurement instrument towards that. That is sort of the background of the question that I had. Is there an inventory of things to look for, essentially, in that data set?
Can I just jump in here for a second, Olaf? Is that actually this could also be useful for this communication and outreach activity. These are the sorts of things we expect could go wrong. So if you as an operator find yourself restarting your name servers much more often than you would normally expect to do, here's what it might be. Sorry, Johan.
Yeah, I basically agree with what Olaf said. So the point is not, oh, this is all wrong, we shouldn't do it. Absolutely not. Of course we should do it. I'm just concerned that the whole point with the staged phase-in is that we'll be able to draw conclusions from stats. And if we're unable to draw conclusions from stats, that added complexity is sort of pointless. So we really, really, really need to sit down and figure out what Olaf said, fingerprints of what will be useful information in advance, because we must have that beforehand. Okay?
Well, I think there's also the point that we expect to hear about things that come up that we didn't expect during this process. And if we want to give ourselves time to be able to examine those specific footprints based on the feedback we get, we also need the deployment schedule not to be too short.
Okay. Neil?
Neil O'Reilly, University College Dublin. I think there's an important five-letter word that I haven't heard in the room yet. And that's
all the words that come to mind are four letters now.
No, before lunch. I think... Nice one, Daniel. But what I mean is the five-letter word press. We've seen in the business pages and technology pages of our better newspapers in our small country already articles about IPv6. This thing has the same kind of disastrous impact possible. The message needs to be gotten out there beyond the techie community in a big way. And that's it.
Last comment from Johan, and then I need to make some one or two final comments myself.
I actually have another five-letter word. Thanks.
That's six.
We all want to see this happen.
Thank you, Johan. And that really brings me back to the thing I would like to close out this discussion with. I think we've all given Joe and Matt some good ammunition from some good feedback that will help them with the plans for the future rollout of the signed route. Now, you may remember back at the Tallinn meeting that I think we kind of had our hands and set the ball rolling here by issuing the statement that please sign the route and get this done. So I think it would be rude of us not to make some kind of response from this working group or from the RIPE community to say thank you and to say that we support those efforts. I assume we all do support those efforts, but I do think we should have some kind of response to that. So can I have a sense from those in the room if we think this would be a good idea to have some kind of communication that either comes from this working group or maybe even from the RIPE community to say thank you for doing this and we look forward to seeing a signed route next year? Yes? Thank you. Okay, what I'll try to do is put some kind of words together and present them to the working group in the afternoon session just to see if we can get some kind of acceptance by acclamation. That's the right way forward. I'd like to thank Joe and Matt for coming here and giving the presentations and all the other speakers for this morning, and also to the scribes, people doing the transcription, the jabbering. Thank you very much. Let's all have lunch and I'll see you back here at 2.
I wasn't there to thank, because I left you earlier. I stayed there.